Henry, can I ask you first of all, when and where were you born, and what was your name at birth?
My name at birth was Heinz Martin Wuger. I was born in Nuremberg, Germany, on the 23rd of February 1924.
Thank you. When did you arrive in Scotland?
I arrived in Scotland on the 5th of May 1939.
So what age were you then?
15 and a half.
Yes. How did and why did you come to Scotland?
Well, we came to Scotland because we had to get out of Germany. This is fairly obvious what went on there, especially coming from the town of Nuremberg, where the notorious Nuremberg laws were promulgated in 1935. At home, I had a very nice upbringing, my father and mother. I'm an only child. But my mother, coming from a catering background, my grandfather had a brewery, my mother decided at the age of 14, I should leave school. She said, you better learn something, you'll need it. And I became an apprentice in a very strictly kosher hotel in Baden-Baden in the Black Forest at the age of 14. And I was only there 6 months up to Kristallnacht. I learned a lot, but that stood me in good stead.
What about your parents, Henry?
My parents. My father, Karl Wuger, came from Austria. My mother, Lore Würzburger, came from Heilbronn, from Württemberg. They got married in the early 20s, just after my father was a prisoner in the First World War in Italy. And they got married, and I came along in 1924. My mother must have been in her late 30s by then, yes? I was an only child. My father had a small stationery business, a wholesale stationery business, which he ran himself, and my mother helped there. And then, of course, when Hitler came, things became very difficult. I left by Kindertransport. My father died in 1941 of a heart attack really, I don't think it had anything to do with the air raid. He passed away, right? My mother was left alone, which was, of course, fairly horrible for her. We had neighbors behind, in the house behind, lived a girl a year older than I was, very staunch Catholic. She worked for Caritas, this big Catholic organization in Germany. And through her, the chairman of Caritas, a very high-powered monsignor, he knew my mother well, he arranged for her to be taken away to a village and hidden. And in the village, I mean, money changed hands, there's no question about that. And in the village, she pretended she was a refugee from the East. You know, nothing Jewish was said, otherwise nobody would have taken her in. And she survived there. She survived there for a year and a half, I think. And then the Americans came and won the war and marched into Germany. The Americans came and my mother, the first contact I had with my mother, an American soldier, a Jewish American soldier, wrote to me, and that's how we got in contact. So she with this girl went back to Nuremberg. Her flat was destroyed in bombing, but simply, my mother was a very forceful character. She simply marched across the road to a woman in a flat who was a Nazi and told her, you go out, I go in, and she did. And she and the girl took over that flat. And she survived there. The problem is to get her out. The difficulty, you have no idea if you've ever anything to do with the Home Office. I mean, you read the paper every day with all these incomers, the refugees we have. My heart bleeds for them.
Did you ever go back to Germany?
Yes, good question. Certainly go back to Germany. Why? At the beginning we went back to Germany because the people that hit my mother saved her life. And they put themselves on the line. If they would have been found out, they would have been shot. So I owed something to these people. They were very friendly. They don't exist any longer. They've all passed away. So I now, well, we've been invited back. The town of Nuremberg invited us. You know, they invite Jewish ex-residents now and again. We've been there. And Nuremberg, of course, has trying to transform itself from the notorious town where the party rallies were held to a community which will look after other people. I mean, in Nuremberg there's now a street with 15 pillars for peace and friendship. It's quite unbelievable how the town is trying to live down this horrendous history. I mean, when the Nazi rallies were, I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of these people, and they were marching past our street. We were living in one of the main streets. And we had a domestic maid who was very left-wing, a German girl, very left-wing. And one day she opened the window and she put her hand out and she shouted out, "The mustard is running over the brown shirts." Now, my father pulled her in, shut the windows. We would have been smashed to bits and pieces. Kristallnacht, I escaped Kristallnacht. I was in Baden-Baden in that hotel and as an apprentice. Well, I really learned a lot there because the chef was taken away. The chef was taken away to the German army. Oh, I'll give you another. I've got lots of tales, but we got a new supervisor, a young woman. We had 50 pounds of spinach for lunch. Do you know what 50 pounds of spinach looked like? The volume of this, four of us. So she picks up the first spinach. She goes like this. I said, "What is it?" I said, "I'm looking. I have to examine it." I said, "Yes." I said, "I'm sorry. You cannot, it will not be ready tomorrow." I mean, I was 14 and a half. We wash it four times in salted water. She accepted that, but just shows you, you know, it's absolutely, that was that hotel, very strict, very strict. I also learned a lot there, but again, Kristallnacht came. I worked there for 6 months till I went home on the, I think, the 2nd of November. I worked for 6 months, 6 days a week, 6.5 days a week. Got a half day off. Okay, that's how it was in these days. Not only that, you had to pay them to learn something. You follow? Very strict. So after 6 months, I said, "I'm going home to see my parents." "You can't do that." I said, "Well, I'm sorry, I'm going to see my parents." In Baden-Baden, the whole community was locked into the synagogue and was set alight. Nobody lost their life. Nevertheless, I went home. I was at home in Kristallnacht. But they didn't come to our house, but they came to all houses around us. And I saw people getting beaten up. I saw a piano flying out of a first floor window, smashing on the pavement. Unbelievable. But so I escaped. And after that, of course, it became, we had to leave. You know, it's quite important that we had to leave. Can I just say, schooling in Germany? Yes, you went to a school. When the Nuremberg laws came out, when Hitler came, I went to the local school and you were then, there were three Jewish boys in the class. You were sat at the back. Nobody would speak to you, neither the teachers nor anything else. So Nuremberg was like, Nuremberg in Fürth is like Glasgow and Paisley, a smaller town beside Nuremberg, a Frum town, no, a bit like Gateshead. Fürth had a Jewish grammar school and a Jewish old age home and a Jewish, good God, I can't remember, an orphanage, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we went to school in Fürth, Israelitische Realschule Fürth, a very good school. The only trouble is there were 52 in the class, right? Because the Hitler time. But we went there. We went there by tram, back and forward. It wasn't far. It was an excellent school. One of the teachers had to be non-Jewish, you know, the government insisted, so they'd see what was going on. But it was a very good school. The only thing, obviously, in the morning, Chumash, you know, the rabbi was very strict. But we were not allowed in the tram car, you know, it's a typical Jewish school. The tram car, there were two, the trailer. Boys were to be in the back and girls in the front, but it didn't work like that. We had some very good teachers, some very intelligent teachers. Very good. We were always very kind to them. For example, we meet some, you know, when the teacher, like children, teacher who was a bit weak, he was immediately sidelined by the children. It was horrible. But it was a very good school, excellent school, I must say. And I was taken away from that school, unfortunately, to go to Baden-Baden to learn something, which, in retrospect, my mother was quite clever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was quite clever. It stood me in good stead, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Maybe she had prescience.
Yeah, I know. Life is, well, I'm lucky to be fit and able and very happy to be here. Now, went back to school and then war broke out. Remember, we were friendly enemy aliens due to religious persecution. This was our standard. But the minute the war broke out, the police came, you know, there was a curfew. I had to be in by 10:30, being an alien, being an enemy alien. The police came to the door, but there was no problem. We weren't hounded. I mean, people were friendly. Only certain things you had to do. I went back to school for 2 days. Then we were evacuated. Okay. From station in Victoria Road, Queen's Park Station, I was evacuated to Perthshire. a little place called Guildtownville, near Guildtown, on a farm. I was very lucky. On a farm, they had two children, a big farm, 600 acres, with a tractor, horses, a bothy. So I learned to speak Scots, you know, Tories and stuff like that. We went, we did potato picking, obviously, and we worked quite a bit on the farm, which was great. I mean, there was no shortage of food. We had cream. I mean, it was a farm after all. There were tinned peaches, I mean, and there were pheasants. It was absolutely wonderful. And I went to the local village school in Guildtown. And then I was transferred to Perth, to the bigger school, Perth Academy. Perth Academy did not accept me. My English wasn't good enough, okay? So I was sent to a junior secondary school, Balhousie Boys School, Perth. Now, I tell you all that because you're young. These things stay with you. Now, I'm quite glad Perth Academy didn't accept me. Balhousie Boys School, the headmaster, Mr. Bothwick, I mean, I remember all this. I've got good recall in these things. He was very kind to me. And, I mean, I was the only foreign boy there in Perth, opposite the Black Watch barracks. What got me there, I was there for till December. I was there about 3 months. What they did one Shakespeare play, Macbeth. Now, that, funnily enough, I got to grips with that. I can still quote you whole passages of Macbeth to this day. And they were very kind. Certain exams, I could sit in German and somebody would translate it into English. And I got a leaving certificate eventually. I got fairly good marks, only being there after a few months. We were transferred from that farm eventually. We were transferred to the other side of Perth, a place called Forgandenny, a village by the name of Forgandenny, near Bridge of Erne. A house of Colonel Sir James Hutchison, a country estate, was taken over by the Glasgow school system, and we were lodged there with 30 or 40 other children. There were other two Jewish children there. So we stayed in this Rossi house for a day. We took the train into school. There was no problem. It was very nice. It was well catered for. It was a school from the West End. Going to school by bicycle. This was at the time of Dunkirk. So they had put roadblocks. I mean, you know, they put cement bollards over the road. The tank could have gone around this field. It didn't matter. In any case, roadblocks. So you had to show identification. I had an aliens book. So the little soldiers, they were looking for German spies. Here I come on my bicycle. There is written down nationality German. Well, that soldier, I can only tell you, he nearly wet his pants. I mean, he sent for the corporal sent for the sergeant, the sergeant sent for the officer, he said, let the boy go to school. But I mean, it's quite, this remains in your memory, yes? So that it went on like that, no problem. I corresponded with my parents. That became the problem afterwards. And when I became 16, I should have registered. That was after Christmas, February. I forgot to register. And it became a protected area. You may not be aware of that. The whole of Great Britain, anything within 5 miles of the coast or certain parts of the country where they stored ammunition or had army barracks, were not allowed for enemy aliens of any kind to stay there. So I had to leave school, and I was sent home to Glasgow, back to Mrs. Harwich, because this became a protected area. You simply could not stay. Edinburgh was protected. You couldn't stay anywhere near the coast. So I came home to Glasgow, and it didn't last very long. That I have a different story. I was then arrested for corresponding with the enemy. May I explain to you? I wrote to my mother and father when war broke out. Of course, this postal service ceases completely. But I had uncles in Paris and in Belgium, and I wrote to my uncle in Belgium, Sally Würzburger, and he sent the letters to my mother, and like this it went. Obviously, censorship, the letters were censored. I was accused of corresponding with the enemy, which was, in wartime, you know, we're laughing now, it was a very serious offense. I've got, if the archives are in there, I've got all these letters, etc. here. In any case, I was told to come to a tribunal in Edinburgh. The committee arranged a lawyer for me. We went to Edinburgh. The lawyer was not allowed in. So I'm here, I'm 16 years of age, I'm standing in the High Court in Edinburgh. Sir James Strachan became Lord Strachan later, and two assessors who were well informed. They knew my uncle in Paris had changed addresses, so they were. I was amazed how well informed they were. I committed this offense, and I was found guilty of that offense. This was the problem. They didn't know what to do with me. You're underage. I wasn't handcuffed, thank God for that. I was taken from the court to Haymarket Station in Edinburgh. I was locked in a compartment to Queen Street, and at Queen Street, two detectives came on the train and opened the compartment, took me to Queen's Drive to Mrs. Hedge. I was to pack a case. I had two phone calls. I was allowed two phone calls, and I was taken away. They were very kind. I mean, traumatic, yes. I mean, but you're 16. You've just got to cope with this. Traumatic it was, I grant you. But nevertheless, there was no ill treatment, no abuser, anything like that. The two detectives were very, you know, they've got a kid there. What are they to do? Got to St. Andrew's Square police station, which in these days was. The sergeant said, "Can I take him?" "Nay, laddie under 17 is allowed in a cell." Very civilized country, Scotland. So they didn't know what to do with me. They sent me to a remand home in St. Vincent Street. Now, a remand home which contained young children from other remand homes which had to appear in court the next day. Right? So I got to this remand home. I must have been the oldest. I mean, I'm talking about 12-year-old. The first thing he said, "What did you do?" Well, I did my day nothing, you see. So I ended up at the bottom of the pile. And the commander, the chairman, the manager of this remand home, he was very kind, but very naive. He was very naive, and I knew better. You know, in these days, we all smoked. You smoked. You weren't allowed cigarettes. He said, "You must leave the cigarettes in my office, and if you want to smoke, come to my office." Now, I knew better. I mean, you're in amongst the lot. You don't go to the manager's office for a smoke. You would have been absolutely. I knew better than that. I was there for 3 days, and then they decided they had to take me. They took me to Maryhill Barracks, which doesn't exist anymore. Maryhill Barracks in Maryhill Road. I was put in an underground bunker with 20, well, I can't say German soldiers, German merchant seamen. I don't know if you know or remember, there was the Icelandic blockade. The British Navy would not let any foreign ships come, civilian ships, to supply Germany. So when they captured the ship, they interned the crew. So these were German merchant seamen who I was interned with in Maryhill Barracks for at least 3 weeks, which wasn't pleasant, I can tell you. Some were very anti, one or two were quite kind. And we were there for several weeks, and then we were transferred to Donaldson School in Edinburgh. You know, that deaf and dumb school? Mm-hmm. That became our internment camp, where we were interned there for quite a while. I'm now going back to the internment camp in Edinburgh. I remember the commandant of that camp, it was Donaldson School. There were only these 20 German merchant seamen and myself. And he said, "Is there anybody here that can cook?" Well, I learned, you know, if any volunteer for something, if you're in a prison camp, it always helps you. I said, "Yes." Well, I was put in charge of the kitchen. But I had these Germans sealed as my kitchen staff. One called me a dirty Jew, and another one knocked him out or whatever. In any case, the commandant said to me, "You have to prepare a meal for 200 people arriving within the next 72 hours, because by then, general internment of friendly enemy aliens was decreed in the cabinet. Nothing has changed. The tabloid press, the Express, particularly the Daily Mail, you know, intern them, they're enemy aliens." And Churchill got fed up and he said, "Call it a lot." He banged the table in cabinet. And we ended up eventually on the Isle of Man. So I came from there to various other camps. It was very traumatic, but you learn a lot. Eventually I spent 10 months in internment in the Isle of Man. Ended up in the Isle of Man, where we were very well treated. But it was a high-powered learning curve for a young boy. I mean, I must have been amongst one of the youngest. Most people were, what, in their mid-40s or whatnot, yeah? A lot of academics, a lot of music, the Amadeus Quartet, Lord Weidenfeld. I mean, all the winners of prizes, of Nobel prizes, of prestigious prizes, the Rudolf Piles, the atomic people, they were all, this was a high-powered learning curve. I remember these men playing chess. You know, they had wives and children, sure. Playing chess with their back to the table, were allowed 5 seconds for a move, call out the square. So this is the kind of place it was. The problem was, I got a new roommate, and he tried to get me drunk a few times. He said he was an officer, a German army officer, working for the British Aluminium Company in Fort William, which was quite true. He was an MI5 man. His German was perfect, his English was perfect, fantastic. So he pumped me for information, yeah? I didn't have any information. I really think they did suspect me of writing these letters. You know, a child letter can be used to communicate with the enemy quite simply. In any case, I was released during my stay in the camp. I was, again, before tribunals, and I became from enemy A, dangerous enemy alien, down to B, and then I became C. And when I became C, friendly enemy alien, the commandant said to me, he said, I'm sorry, you're under the age of internment, we have to send you home. Now, after 10 months internment, the worst thing was being sent home. You're given a ticket, and then you're in the open wild world. You've been with your group of people, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, be army or prison, doesn't matter. So here you go, you have to change trains in Preston, it was all, you manage, but it was quite frightening. Yes. Only 2 years ago, I say to myself, this story, did they really suspect me? Come on. So I wrote to my MP, I said, what can I do? He said, well, write to the National Archives. Well, lo and behold, it's all there. They sent me stuff. They sent me stuff which has to be seated for another 27 years. I said, do me a favor. But because I'm the inquirer and I'm the subject of the inquiry, they released all these things for me. And I've got all the correspondence from the National. I mean, when you think 70 years later, it's all there and you can access it, yeah? Under the Freedom of Information Act. Yes. It's quite amazing.
Yes. And did that explain?
The date, yes, oh yes, it explained. I can show you. I've got all these things. I think I might give them to the archives in Glasgow.
Yes. They can scan it, I think.
They can scan it, they can look at it. It's very interesting, all this correspondence.
What does that reveal about...
It didn't reveal anything. It said, one chief constable said, the boy should not be left at Freedom, he's a danger, he should be interned. And when they examined me again, he said, excuse me, the boy's of above average intelligence, and he should return to Mrs. Harwich in Glasgow. So you see how it changed over the period. It was very interesting. I came to Glasgow on kinder transport. My mother found a place for me on the kinder transport, but we had a connection in Glasgow. In Glasgow, my mother's cousin, Mrs. Gummers the dentist, they emigrated to Glasgow from Germany. So my mother asked Grete Gummers, could she find a place for me? And the committee in Glasgow, the ladies' committee, Mrs. Dora Wolfson and Mrs. Thelma Mann, found me a place, and I came by kinder transport to Glasgow.
Can you tell us about your experiences when you were coming to Glasgow, coming on the kinder transport?
Yes, well, it's traumatic to start with. You're taken to the station, you wave goodbye to your parents, you have no idea whether you will ever see them again. It was quite traumatic, really. On the other hand, may I tell you, being a boy and being somewhat adventurous, I was always interested in travel and where to go and what to do. I fully understood, coming from Nuremberg, I mean, I was politically aware of what, why, and where, and how. I said to my mother, why must I go with this train straight to London and then to Glasgow? Why can't I take a train via Paris and stay with my cousin for a week? It wasn't like that, but you understand, that didn't, in any case, you're in the train with all these other children, some very young, some very traumatized, crying, whatever. When we crossed the German frontier, things became easier. The German soldiers left the train. We were in Holland, and everybody will tell you from the Kindertransport. In Holland, wherever the train stopped at the station, there were groups of women, Dutch women, with chocolate and apples and sandwiches. It was really quite amazing. Hoek van Holland, overnight on the boat, the first time I crossed the channel, the first time I've seen the sea, it was nighttime. I arrived in Harwich the next morning, again onto a train, taken to Liverpool Street Station, underground, a huge waiting room, I mean down below, a black hole, there must have been about 200 children and all the paraphernalia of the committees and children being collected. And myself and other two children were kept there. We were sitting there for hours. Everybody was collected. We were not. We were going on to Glasgow the next day. So we stayed in London overnight at some hostel. So you're sitting there for hours. It was quite horrendous. But next day we left for Glasgow. We were taken to Euston Station by the Flying Scot, and never having been in a compartment with upholstery before. I mean, in Germany, we traveled third class in wooden benches. It was quite interesting, and we were taken to the dining car, waiters, I mean, in these days, with white gloves, with silver teapots. And I remember that little girl wouldn't take this or that. She wanted hot chocolate. Well, she got hot chocolate. So that was quite an experience coming here, arriving in Glasgow. Of course, I was collected by my second cousin and taken to my new lodgings.
And what did you lodge with?
The lady that took me in was a Mrs. Etta Harwich. She lived in Queen's Drive, 169 Queen's Drive. The lady must have been in her mid-60s. Her children were all grown up and no longer in Glasgow. One daughter was in Glasgow. Her son, who ran the factory, and she still ran, they had an upholstery factory. He was still at home. And they took me in. She was a wonderful lady, a very intellectual lady, I must say. She took me to theater, she took me to music, and she made me feel very much at home. It was very, very interesting, very kind people.
But it must have been traumatic for you, Henry.
It is. The language is different, the food is different, everything is different. But, well, you just have to cope with it. It was traumatic, but, I mean, I did manage to get through it. Some of the younger ones found it rather difficult.
What age were you when you arrived in Glasgow then?
15 and a half, 15
and
yeah.
A half. And what, did you go to school then?
Yes. Well, the first thing that happened, Mrs. Harwich had grandchildren and friends in the West End. I got in touch with them. I was taken there, obviously. Then the Sassoons of Kirkcudbright, the family Sassoon, David Sassoon and his wife Vera, lived in Kirkcudbright with two sons. They invited me on holiday. So I came here. I was taken, Mrs. Harwich insisted I should go to school, I went to Queen's Park School, only for a few weeks, because then the holidays intervened, yes, the summer holidays. And then I went to the Sassoons for 4 weeks.
Is that a relative of Siegfried?
Exactly, a relative of Siegfried, a brother of Siegfried. Brother of Siegfried. David Sassoon, a painter, who moved to Kirkcudbright with his wife and two sons. He didn't have anything to do with the banking and the horse racing. Mm-hmm. He moved to Kirkcudbright. His son still lives in Kirkcudbright. Joey Sassoon, still a very good friend of mine. That was interesting. We lived in they had a huge house in Kirkcudbright. Lovely carpets and paintings and whatnot. But we lived on Carrick Shore in a hut, no electricity, no water, tilly lamps. I mean, that's how it was. My first connection with the sea. Now, I don't know if you know the Solway Firth. The tide goes out for 3 miles, yes? Mm-hmm. So be careful you're not caught by the tide. It was very interesting for me. Wonderful time to be had with another friend. We stayed with him for 3 weeks and been friendly with him ever since. Mm-hmm. When we came back to Glasgow, went back to school.
So when was it you were released from internment then?
Internment, I must have been 1941.
And by then you were aged, what?
16 and a half.
So you went back to Mrs.
Harwich? I went back to Mrs. Harwich, mm-hmm. And then we decided what I should do. I was offered I could have gone to study, I could have gone into the upholstery business, but I decided to go back into catering, and I found a job in John Smith and Company, the Grosvenor and the Corn Exchange, a big Glasgow catering company. And I worked in the Corn Exchange restaurant under Chef Hausdorfer and in the Rogano and in various places. Eventually, I went to the Beresford Hotel, And while in the while I was in the Beresford Hotel, I started off as a chef de partie, and I became sous chef. And eventually, in the Grand Hotel, I became chef de partie. I was in charge of the Grand Hotel in Sookie Hall Street, which is that 1930s building. You know, it's now a student residence. Opposite Elm Bank Street.
Yes,
that,
yes, right.
That was the Beresford, not Grand. Beresford Hotel. Then I went on from the Beresford Hotel to the Grand Hotel, which was at Charing Cross. It's now a motorway hole. That was the big Grand Hotel, belonged to the cooperative. I became chef de partie there. Mm-hmm. I became head chef there, chef de cuisine. And I was there, my whole career was there, and eventually I left there and went to France.
When was that?
In 1953, I went to France and worked for a few months in France, by which time I was married. And then I came back here, and then I went back to the Grand Hotel, but after that I went out of the Grand Hotel. I did other things. So that was quite an interesting period. I catering in these days, when I started, it was wartime. Rationing was fairly strict. You could buy so much fish, and when it was finished, there was a limited supply. Nevertheless, there was only a price restriction in Great Britain. You could not charge more than 5 shillings for a meal. You didn't need coupons like in other countries. Your ration book did not. You could go to a restaurant. This country was quite different from other countries. You could go to a restaurant during the war here if you had the money and if there was enough food. You didn't. It had nothing to do with your rationing. There's another story. It's you know, fate. You wanted to do something. I wanted to join the Merchant Navy. I wanted, in the Isle of Man, in the internment camp, we were given, if you wanted early release, you were given the chance to join the Pioneer Corps. Well, the Pioneer Corps was the lowest of the low. We wanted to fight Hitler, but something better than the Pioneer Corps. So I didn't join the Pioneer Corps. I was released. When I came to Glasgow, I went to the Labour Exchange, in these days known as the Beru in Waterloo Street, yes?
Still
the Beru. I want to join the Navy. I didn't get. I wrote letters to my MP, didn't get. I wanted to go to Hillington, you know, to make munitions, whatever. In the Labour Exchange in Waterloo Street sits this young boy. I don't think he was a year older than I was. And he looked at me and he said, Specky, he called me Specky. Specky, he said, you'll go nowhere. We also need people to cook for the public. Now, this 17-year-old clerk in a Labour Exchange, any application I made, he tore it up and threw it in the bin. Incredible. So I spent the war here in Glasgow in cooking for the public, so to speak. And in the Grand Hotel, eventually, I was responsible for starting kosher catering.
At the Grand Hotel?
Yeah, the Grand Hotel.
And then you started up your own
I first, I went into business with somebody else, with pet foods and bird cages that didn't work out. And then I started out my own catering business.
When was that?
That must have been, let me see, 1962, something like that, yeah? So that was quite successful.
I'm sure you catered for my
permission. Yes, I did. Oh, yes, definitely.
That was 1961.
Well, there you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were one of the first. Your mother, I remember, your mother lived in the West End.
Garden Street.
Steep Street. I remember that very.
1961.
Yes, that's right. Yes. There you are.
So yes, catering. Yeah.
That was at the beginning. Yes,
that's good. And how long were you a kosher caterer in Glasgow?
Till 1990. Yeah. And 1990. That's right.
What can you say about your experiences as a kosher caterer?
Experience of kosher caterer are very, very interesting. You know, people say, how can you do that? Very simple. Of course, you have to earn a living, you can do that. It was interesting in the respect, you got to know a lot of people, and you got to know people, you know, you're doing a function for them. You had to go and discuss the menu. It spread by word of mouth. It boomed very, very quickly, because obviously what we did was the right thing at the time. It boomed very quickly, and I didn't have to do any advertising. Within 2 years, it grew out of all proportion. Because we tried to get away from chopped liver and chicken soup, we tried to broaden things out. You know, obviously, I had different background. Because people, let's face it, in these days here, they were extremely blinkered, absolutely blinkered. I mean, anything out with a can, it, you know, you didn't, it might not be kosher. I mean, I remember the supervisor, I'm giving, you can't give mayonnaise. I said, what do you mean I can't give mayonnaise? But it's white in color. I said, there's nothing to, it's not made with cream or milk. You follow. They had no knowledge that mayonnaise is made from eggs. People had no knowledge. They were rather very, very inhibited. So we broadened that out. We also, but interesting experiences, obviously. Most things with most people, I had very good relations. We went very well. People paid their bills. One or two didn't pay their bills at the very beginning. Somebody didn't pay their bill. So I took them to court. I was told, you don't do that. I said, watch me. And it established. After that, I had no trouble. No trouble whatsoever. People are people. Look,
You say you were bringing a new, more continental style of catering to Glasgow.
Yes, oh yes. Mm-hmm. For example, this is how somebody said to me, look, can you not do something about prawn cocktail? So we use salmon. You follow people, you know, other people, then people came back from abroad. Could we have crudités on the table? Okay. Mm-hmm. Half the Henry, what is this? Have you no time to cook the vegetables? You know, look, it grew, obviously. Yeah. It grew, and people grew with it. People began to learn. But at the beginning, it was very, very restrictive.
So you were very restrictive.
Well, in a way, yes. In a way, well, we brought in different things, yeah. And that's how it is.
How did you meet your wife, Ingrid?
How did I meet my wife, Ingrid? When we came to Glasgow, Ingrid came to Glasgow later. When we arrived in Glasgow, I was with a Jewish family. Most people were Jewish families, but some weren't. But when you are young and you're a refugee and you have a problem with language, etc., first of all, you try and get together. So there was the refugee center, the house on the hill in Sookie Hall Street, which was a most important place. We were very active there, yes? There were discussions, there were theater groups. Most people, of course, we were the young ones. We had a choir, and we were very politically active, of course. That was very much so. Very left-wing, as it was in these days. We marched on the 1st of May. We fought. We performed all over Scotland, in the Usher Hall in Edinburgh, in Aberdeen, for Mrs. Churchill's Aid to Russia Fund, to raise money for a second fund or whatever. It was also very, very left-wing, very big communist influence as well. There was no question about it. I mean, I wrote pamphlets with Heine Price, and it was an amazing, amazing group of people. Fairly intelligent, some of them very clever, very high-powered, very politically active. My Ingrid's father wasn't keen. He said, you shouldn't get involved in that. Well, yes, you see, now, when you get older, you look back on this. Of course, you get involved in that. But there is such a thing as MI5. Let's face it. You know, you might be sent back if you misbehave. But we were very politically active. And this is where I met Ingrid. Mm. It was on a Sunday, we went in rambles. I mean, remember, none of us had money. Most of us had no jobs. We were still studying or whatever. On a Sunday, we went out on walks with a number 4 tram to Clarkson and Crofoot and up in the hills. But we all, well, you brought a sandwich or something, but as we were very egalitarian, you weren't allowed to eat your own sandwich because you had money, the others didn't, so they were thrown in the middle and you took lucky dip. This is how things were, yeah? This is where I met Ingrid.
Yes.
And we met lots of people whom we were very friendly with, and stayed friendly. How did we integrate into the larger community? Well, that also came later. I mean, we joined the music society, and people ask us, when you come like that, you can be accused of being clannish. You stick to yourself. Well, all right, you do. As a group of refugees or foreigners in the country, of course you stick to yourselves. He said, if you don't want us to stick together, you have to invite us. We can't knock on your door, let me in. You have to do it. It has to come from the other side. It takes a long time, but it did come, and we became very integrated, obviously. But, you know, people said, you're clannish, you all stick together. And I always say to them, I said, look, Scots, emigrate to Canada. What's the first thing they do? They join the Caledonian Society. I mean, that's how it is. Yes? And then, of course, they come back home on holiday. We had no, this home for us did not exist. Now, when we were, while I was in that refugee center, there was all something called Free German Youth. It sounds terrible, but yeah. Freie Deutsche Jugend. That there was this left-wing push, people going back to Germany to rebuild after the war. Well, we never, 90% of us did not have this intention. 10% did. Well, obviously, some people went back to help re-establish a new country. When I was in Berlin at the Jewish Museum the other day, last year, he produced a booklet written by a chap who came to interview me once years ago. And when I see my name there, Heinz Ruger, I was the Gauleiter, so to speak, for Scotland. I mean, it you know, if MI5 gets hold of this kind of thing, you get expelled. So it was quite tremendous what went on. But none of us, I mean, from all the people we knew here, I think only 4 or 5 went back to Germany, to Austria or Czechoslovakia to rebuild a democratic system. Fine. But we had no intention of doing that. It took me 1945. It took me till 1947 to bring my mother to Glasgow. The amount of affidavits you needed, I mean, and you had to sign that she would not fall on the public purse, etc. But eventually she did come here, saved her life, she came here. She hated Glasgow, even though I was an only child. She absolutely hated Glasgow. What she didn't like either, that I was married. You see, one son, this little boy, and all of a sudden he's a married man. Now, she liked Ingrid as a person, not as a wife. So much so, well, too. But she's a mother. I mean, she's a wonderful woman, my mother. But nevertheless, I tell this quite openly. She never said a bad thing about Ingrid. On the other hand, she respected Ingrid, but not as a wife. So after 2 years, my mother left Glasgow to live with her sister in Brooklyn. Would you believe that? Yeah? Absolutely. So much so. And she was a very tough lady. She, in Brooklyn, she started working in restaurants and hotels. She made a life for herself. She lived there for over 25 years. She even got a social security number and a pension. She became an American citizen, a very proud American citizen. She said, in the United States, nobody asks me, where do you come from? They ask you, what can you do? Which she has a point. You see, here, a woman in her 50s, 60s, trying to get a job in Glasgow was fairly impossible. She worked for another refugee people here making stuffed animals, but she hated it. And she went to America. And every year we, with our children, we went to America 1 year and she came here the next year. So we had constant contact. And eventually when her sister passed away, she came to stay with us in Pollock Shields. And she passed away here in Glasgow, aged 89. So tough, but she did it, yeah.
What would you say was the attitude of Scottish people to Jewish people when you were...
The general Scottish public, I don't think I ever, apart from the odd anti-Semitic remark, I never had any problems. I think only once in the street was I accosted, and possibly not because I was Jewish, possibly because I was foreign. But I must say, people on the whole, I mean, Glasgow's a tough city, I know that, and a criminal city, etc. But really, I had no problem. I have no problem with that whatsoever.
What about your involvement in the Jewish community in Glasgow?
Well, the people I stayed with were Jewish family. They took me to Queen's Park Synagogue. I became a member of Queen's Park Synagogue with their family. And when I got married, we moved to Pollock Shields. We then went to Pollock Shields Synagogue, which doesn't exist any longer. We got married in Pollock Shields Synagogue. And we had lots of Jewish friends, obviously, in the music society, the literary society. And Ingrid was a dressmaker in these days, got to know other people. And eventually, when Pollock Shields Synagogue dissolved, I went back to Queen's Park. And when Queen's Park Synagogue dissolved, I finally went to the Reform Synagogue, which I feel very happy with. I could never have done that while I was a kosher caterer. You can imagine there were pressures. There were certain, obviously there were pressures, But that I feel quite at home there, but I felt quite at home in Queensbury.
Why did you decide to move to the Reform?
Because, why did I decide to move to the Reform? My background, my German-Jewish background, is much more liberal, not as orthodox, as the general community was here. Yes, so that really was not a step away. This would eventually happen. I could not do that. Well, I wouldn't. The Bethdin wouldn't have given me a license, a kosher, because I don't want to go into the religious problems. But there are lots of, as you can imagine, we had lots of problems with the Bethdin. When I applied for a license, you know, I started catering. I started kosher catering, no problem. Then all of a sudden, but we have a bar mitzvah. Well, if we would like you to do the bar mitzvah, but if you do the bar mitzvah, the rabbi won't come. Well, all right. This is how it was. That's how it is. So I said to myself, I better get a license, otherwise I'll not go anywhere. Rabbi Gottlieb, I don't know if you remember Rabbi Gottlieb. Yes, remember Rabbi Gottlieb.
Very strict.
Well, he was very strict, but he was very strict, but nevertheless, he said to me, well, you want to apply for a license? He said, I'm not sure. We have... should you really do that? We have enough kosher caterers here. I said, but I would like to apply for a license. Well, I said, look, I'm not asking you for business advice. I'm asking you, I would like a license. And eventually he said to me, well, we don't expect you to lie flat on the ground in Tisha B'Av in the synagogue, but you have to conform to certain things. So I got a license, and then Rabbi Gottlieb passed away, and then different kind of Beth Din. There were always problems with the Beth Din. Some people were extremely strict. For example, give you an idea. Obviously, dishes, meat, milk, we know all that. Yeah. Then we had a supervisor, Reverend Ballin, who became an extremely good friend of mine. I miss him very much. He was a very nice man. But he was very strict.
He might have cleared him myself. Yeah.
Did he? He was very strict. His boundaries had supervisors. He's got to, but he had a little sense of humor and a little outgoing. So when things happened, he would put them right. On the other hand, you get new dishes. All of a sudden, some frumer from the Colero, new dishes. New dishes have to go to the mikveh. Have your dishes ever been to the mikveh? I said, no, they haven't. You better take your dishes to the mikveh. I mean, we're talking about thousands of pieces. So you know what I did? I said, here are the keys. You can come to my house and take them. I never heard any more. Well, I mean, you had to, I mean, all right, I can understand it, but they get carried away. They get absolutely carried away. Huh? So, but we established a good relationship, yes? Mm-hmm. And may I say, you remember Rabbi Rosen?
Yes.
Right? Yes. I met him the other day. I met him two years ago. Yes. We were going up north. And where do I meet him? In Glenfinnan. I said, what are you doing here? He was here to examine the salmon, you know. He said to me when I left catering, he said to me, you're going out with a good name, which was a very nice thing to say. Yes, that I appreciated. Yes, that I appreciated. We had, look, we have bad things. We had certain debts. Somebody wouldn't pay his bill, a very big bill. So what can you eventually have to take him to court? Nothing happened. He wouldn't. He was fine, but it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, the same man phones me up. He said, I've got another daughter getting married. Would you do it? I said, I will do it if you pay beforehand. Mm-hmm. Apparently, the man was a gambler. Mm-hmm. When he had it, he was a big boy. Mm-hmm. When he lost, he didn't communicate. You know, this is human nature. This is human nature. And another man, I mean, I had hardly any debts. Another man, he had business trouble, he went away. He owed me a few £100, not a big deal. 2 years later, he comes to a function here. He said, Henry, I owe you something. Brings out an envelope. You know, these are tales. It's quite funny. This is,
I won't ask for names.
No, I won't give you names. No, but this is such is life.
Yes,
yeah,
such is life. Henry, can I ask you about something you haven't mentioned, but I know is the love of your life, your skiing?
Yes. Well, I have, let me put it that way. I have skied since the age of 11 or 12. And then, of course, I came here, and then war broke out, and things were difficult, but I've always skied. Funnily enough, I will show you something in a minute, because you mentioned skiing. I'll show you afterwards. So I've always skied. I want to show you a picture. It must be 1949. Yeah, I was married 44, 49. 1947, even during the war. The snow, it was snowing, so I said, India, we need to go skiing. But I had nothing. We went to a shop, we hired skis, we hired gear we had, we hired skis. We skied in Lynn Park, and people looked at us, you know, can we take a photograph? Wait to see the photograph, too funny. So we've always skied. This is, I mean, winter to me is important.
You and Ingrid?
Yes. And eventually in Aviemore, we used to go to Aviemore to Granton and Spee in New Year time with the children, and eventually I saw a ski bike, a ski bob there in a shop, and I said, what's this? And I tried it on the golf course, and I liked it, and I used it extensively here, and then I went abroad with this ski bike. I didn't know abroad there were other people, and then I didn't know there was a British Ski Bob Association, which I joined.
A ski bob association, yes.
And eventually, about 25, 30 years ago, I then got in touch with, through skiing, you know, you get to know people. I've skied with the blind, I've skied with this, and I got to know British Limbless Ex-Servicemen's Association, and I've been with them, associated with them for 30 years now. I became their chief instructor, and we have these amputees, and we go every year. We still go. We have a place, we go to the Ötztal in Austria, with a group of amputees, and this is every winter, this is my life. I mean, this is, and then not only that, all my family ski, all the grandchildren ski, all the children ski. Well, I've only two daughters and two sons-in-law and four grandsons. Mm-hmm. And we've been going skiing for over 30 years as a family every winter. All right, somebody drops out because of exams, but we go late between England and Scotland to get university and school dates together is very difficult for 11 people. But we have gone as a family for...
Where do you go to?
Where do we go? Now, we are the last 18 years, we've gone to Verbier in Switzerland every year. This is absolutely...
Have you been awarded the MBE?
Yes, I've been awarded the MBE for sport for disabled people. Yes. So that gives me greatest pleasure to get an MBE for something you have done yourself. Yes. Not there's also such a thing as the OBE, you know, but what people say, it's a higher grade, but it's very rude to say that. The MBE is my own business, and OBE is other people's bloody business. You get kicked upstairs. No, I'm very proud of that, because that's something, you know, you've done yourself and appreciated.
So the question here, if you look back now on your time in Scotland, what are the highs that stand out for you?
Well, the highs is to establish yourself here and have a family and be together with a family. And I had a good career here. Certainly the Jewish community helped. The catering was successful. And not only that, I'm fairly happy here. It's a nice place to be. I find Glasgow is a good place to be. You're near mountains and the sea, and people are kind. And people say to you when you retire, where are you going to move to? To Spain or to Malta? I'm sorry. I live here. I belong here. My family's here. I go to these places, certainly, but I belong here and I'm perfectly happy here. No desire to go anywhere else.
Are there any lows?
Yes, they're bound to be, yes. Obviously,
what family, all right. Community?
Not so many family lows. Yes, yeah. No, but one just shows you what can happen to you. When I was in the Beresford Hotel, we got a huge consignment of salami in or something, and nobody wanted it. And everybody was given one. Well, take one home. Yeah. Nevertheless, I took one, whatever. But you stole something. Yeah, I got a sack. Oh. Yeah, well, fine. Well, I wouldn't. There was no charge or anything like that. But you were sacked immediately. So that you have to be careful. These things, these things can happen. Yes,
they'd invite people to take. Had others taken it?
Yes, others had taken it. Yes, yes, oh yes, all sacked. Oh, yes, oh yes. Yes, that taught me, be careful. Yes, be very careful what you do. You can easily fall into problems. But there weren't. I can't say there weren't many laws.
Thank you very much, Henry. That was it.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.